You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 28th of September 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
It is a scary thought to think about Republicans in charge all around because they have made it so clear their vision of how to build a future. Their vision is fire all the cops, not the cops on Main Street, the cops on Wall Street.
Is that the next president of the United States, or at least the de facto leader of the opposition? If not Elizabeth Warren, then whom? My guests John Everard and Jacob Parakilis will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including today's meeting between Recep Tayyip Erdogan and Vladimir Putin, the UK's quaint adherence to the idea that the EU will be sorry if it doesn't do as it's told, and...
When I first published Playboy magazine, and certainly when I grew up and when I was in college, having a baby out of wedlock was a scandal. Even oral sex inside of marriage was illegal, and very few people know that. Playboy played a major part in changing all those laws.
The mixed legacy of the late Hugh Hefner, that's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the show. My guests today are Jacob Parakilis, Deputy Head of the US and the Americas Program at Chatham House, and John Everard, former British diplomat, ambassador to the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, among other postings. Welcome both to the show. Now, first of all, it is a meeting which will be prompting a great deal of interest in Western capitals and a greater deal of nervousness. In Ankara today, Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan will host his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin. The countries led by the pair have undergone a remarkable rapprochement from mutual cold shoulders following Turkey's shooting down of a Russian fighter jet less than 2 years ago, to Russia's recent agreement to sell Turkey, which is still in theory a member of NATO, its S-400 missile defence system. Jacob, first of all, what would be top of the agenda as Mr. Putin and Mr. Erdogan sit down together?
It's a toss-up, I would say. I mean, I think the situation in Syria and particularly in light of the Kurdish referendum on Monday, the sort of political future of the triangle between Syria, Turkey, and Iraq is one thing, but also the broader state of sort of where Turkey sits between the West and Russia. I mean, it's the sale of the missile systems, I think, a more interesting thing than it might appear on the tin, because this is a very sophisticated top-of-the-line air defense system. It's advertised as being able to shoot down the American stealth fighters, the F-22 Raptor and the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter. So that Turkey would buy this and then sort of try to integrate it into NATO defense systems, which are designed to defeat this missile. You know, presumably, NATO will be very interested in having a look under the hood of these S-400 systems. I assume the Russians wouldn't sell them to the Turks unless there were some safeguards about sort of not letting the U.S. Air Force take a peek around.
John, the missiles thing is weird, isn't it? Because Turkey being a NATO member, and in fact, not just a NATO member, I think I'm right in saying the possessor of NATO's largest military, it's supposed to buy NATO-compatible kit, and this is it not the very definition of not NATO-compatible kit?
Yes, it is. It's a strange purchase, clearly politically driven, not only NATO-incompatible when it comes to interoperability between Turkish armed forces and other NATO forces, but within Turkey's own forces. So this missile won't actually interoperate with anything else that Turkey has got. It makes very little military sense. It's not that great a missile. It's the best one the Russians have got. Can it defeat an F-22 Raptor? Try it and see. But OK.
Please don't give them ideas, John.
No, OK, you're right. Probably better they don't try it. But he can get much more sophisticated kit from elsewhere. He's just trying to suck out to Putin. Largely, of course, because of the other big issue, the Kurds, about which he is clearly very worried. And he knows that to get a solution to the Kurdish problem on his terms, he needs Russian support.
Well, on the subject of the Kurdish thing, and at this point I am going to insert a plug for this weekend's edition of The Foreign Desk, which will be looking at exactly this issue in some detail. It obviously, Jacob, preoccupies Recep Recep Tayyip Erdogan. He apparently has already spoken to Vladimir Putin about the Turkish independence referendum. Russia has issued a sort of pro forma statement in favour of Iraq's territorial integrity, but then who hasn't? Does Russia really care one way or the other about this?
I don't think Russia cares insofar as whether there's an independent Kurdistan, whether it involves bits of Syrian territory, Iraqi territory. I don't think that's something that Russians have that much interest in, insofar as its own sort of values go. Now, insofar as balancing the different regional things, and especially insofar as it creates major headaches for the Americans and makes things incredibly difficult, because of course the Kurds are central to the U.S. counter-ISIL, U.S.-led, I should say, counter-ISIL campaign, that's a very interesting sort of prospect for Russia. But like a lot of Russian foreign policy initiatives outside of the near abroad, it's not a strategic national interest. It's basically, oh, here's an area where we can make life difficult for the Americans. So let's you know, see where it goes.
There's that also the key point that they are part of a diplomatic process which does not involve the United States. The people deciding what happens following the Kurdish referendum are Russia, Turkey and Iran. Washington was not invited, which of course is part of Putin's sort of self-aggrandizement and his great game plan.
John, they will of course be discussing Syria, and Turkey and Russia along with Iran did agree a de-escalation zone in Idlib province earlier this month. It is a question to which the answer has fluctuated at various points over the last few years, but as far as it's possible to tell, where Syria is concerned, are Russia and Turkey now basically on the same side or not?
This week, yes. This is a bit of a moving feast. Both countries, in the great old phrase, have permanent interests rather than permanent friends, and those interests do not always align. The fact that they're in alignment at the moment shouldn't get us all too excited.
Jacob, looking further afield, how excited potentially are both Erdogan and Putin, or how excited should they or could they be by the fact that they do appear so far to be the only foreign or the only non-American leaders that the current president of the United States actually has a kind word for?
I'm not sure that there's that much to be valued there. I mean, I think what we're seeing in the U.S. is that that what Trump sort of says is not necessarily backed up by American foreign policy. I think there was a sense in Russia right when the election happened that, oh my God, we have this American president who's actually willing to take us at our word, and we can have an equitable relationship as two great powers. You know, that's what we want.
That is one interpretation. The other of them was that they were saying, well, hasn't Agent Trump done well for himself?
There is that interpretation, which we'll leave to the side for the moment. But I think, I mean, you know, what we've seen, especially with regards to the sanctions legislation that came through, massive bipartisan support. I think 3 votes in total between the House and Senate against it. You know, they are not going to be able to sort of turn Trump's kind words into meaningful actions. Trump just doesn't have as much power over the sort of formal levers of the bureaucracy as he might have if he had been a little bit more attentive.
I think he has enormous negative power. I think we're seeing a new diplomatic weapon here, the Trump endorsement. Having Donald Trump be nice about you must be the ultimate political kiss of death. And I keep wondering whether he's got a secret hotline to Vladimir Putin. He says, no, Putin, unless you do what I want in Ukraine, I'll say you're a good guy, I'll say you're clever again.
Well, we are now drifting into that trap that Donald Trump has set to the entire world of making absolutely everything about him. But he does have that knack, does he not, John, that, you know, in the same way that he has inadvertently revitalized liberal journalism in the United States. Every time he tweets about the failing New York Times, they put on another 10,000 subscribers.
Yes, absolutely. It's the law of unintended effects, isn't it? That everything that Donald Trump loathes and reviles seems to be growing strength from strength to strength under his presidency.
Well, on that happy thought, we will move along slightly to contemplate the UK ongoing efforts to extricate itself from the EU. We're going to do that because there is not to hand a goat attempting to learn how to skateboard. The UK's Brexit Secretary, David Davis, has claimed that decisive steps forward, close quote, have been made in the most recent round of talks, although, as has generally been the case, his EU interlocutors gave every impression of having attended a different meeting, saying there remained big gaps between the two sides, which might take weeks or months, years, decades, centuries, who knows, to resolve before talks about future relations can even begin. Now, John, one of the reasons we enjoy having you on the programmes is so you can can translate diplomatic speak into English for the rest of us. When somebody in David Davis's somewhat rickety position comes out of a meeting saying that decisive steps forward have been taken, what does he mean?
When David Davis comes out of any meeting saying almost anything, it means virtually nothing. This is just another example of that general truth. David Davis appears to have disappeared onto a parallel universe somewhere, completely disconnected from any kind of reality, and just soaked in the belief that somehow, some way, he's going to get these talks started. The European bureaucrats, as you call them, the negotiators, are doing their nuts. You know, they actually want to move forward with the deal. They can't get any sense whatever out of Whitehall on a vital range of detailed propositions that they need to chew over. This is heavy stuff. And David Davis coming out and talking about great decisions is just gump.
Well, to stay with the motif of diplomatic speak, when a diplomat slash bureaucrat actually uses plain phrases like big gaps, that's quite bad, isn't it?
That is quite bad. Big gaps means, well, big gaps. I mean, it's as bad as that. Means that by now, we're a long way into this process, remember. The clock has been ticking very loudly for a while. And there should, at least by this stage, be a broad outline of the, if you like, the battlefront. Everybody knows where everybody else stands, what it is you want, what you might have some give on. And then you can get down to the nitty-gritty, the all-night negotiations that hack away at these positions and bring something together. At the moment, there's just empty spaces. The Europeans are confused.
I suppose we can at least be grateful that no one has used the phrase full and frank exchange of views. But Jacob, the EU is still saying it wants movement on the divorce bill, so-called. The rights of EU citizens in the UK, some 4 million people who don't presently know what their status actually is. The Irish border, where do you even start? Have we heard anything actually serious, tangible, useful on any of these things from the UK government?
My sense is the problem is that the UK government is still sort of consumed by infighting within the Tories, between the Tories and their very small coalition partner, the DUP, not formal coalition partner, but sort of informal coalition partner, between the Tories and Labour, with sort of pro and anti-Brexit, hard and soft Brexit camps all sort of mixed in together. And it's very difficult for the Prime Minister or the Brexit Secretary or the Foreign Secretary to talk in any kind of comprehensive terms about this, because there's so little agreement within the British government about what the end state is. And if you don't agree on the end state, then the path for getting there is not going to be made clear.
Absolutely. One of the interesting points is that the question of the Irish border, although it's tickly, at least that everybody agrees on what the end state should be. Nobody wants there to be a hard border. It's a question of tweaking the machinery to deliver that result. In a sense, that's the easiest bit. It's the other bits that are really tough.
You're saying the Irish border's the easiest bit?
In the sense that we know what the end state should be, yes. Oh, no question.
There's an implicit thing there.
There are many worse places than the Irish border.
When you are embarked on any sort of process of negotiation in which you're looking at the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, thinking that's the easy bit, you're in a world of pain, aren't you?
Absolutely. You summed up nicely.
Jacob, did Theresa May's speech in Florence clear anything up for us?
Not as far as I can tell, no.
Okay. And she gave another speech today at the Bank of England conference, a phrase she deployed which I'm not quite sure meant what she thought it meant. She railed against the idea, well, as she put it, right, this is a direct quote, creating needless new barriers to trade between the EU and its biggest market would benefit no one, which does rather prompt the question of what we're doing.
Yeah, I'm not sure that was sort of fully thought out in all of its potential implications and ramifications before it made it into the teleprompter. I think, you know, that there's where May herself actually sits on all this, because, of course, she wasn't a pro-leave campaigner, but she was a very sort of muffled voice. She was very strategic about not being too far associated with the Remain forces during the referendum campaign. So where she actually stands on all this, how enthusiastic she is. And certainly in the past, you know, when her prime ministership was new, she made a great noise about a red, white and blue Brexit and a successful Brexit, and sort of, you know, emphasizing that the terms of success without actually defining them. And as we've gotten farther and farther, and as the negotiations have kind of dragged on without any evident progress, the distance between those sort of claims of success and the reality, the nitty-gritty details of what it would take for the UK and the EU to establish a new trade relationship outside of the bounds of shared membership in the single market, it's or the customs union, or even, you know, EU politically, it's just become more and more difficult for her to sort of sell that kind of rhetoric.
John, we have seen in the UK over the last week or so the opposition Labour Party having its conference. And I guess 6 months ago, even a few months ago, before the last general election, there would have been really very little reason to take their views on Brexit seriously, because the idea that they would ever form a government under their present leadership appeared, inadmissibly preposterous. That is no longer the case. There is a very meaningful chance that they could be the government of the United Kingdom at some point during the Brexit process. Did they strike you as a bunch of people with any better ideas?
No, I got the sense, the sinking feeling that Jacob just pointed out, that the Tory party appears to be in a state of permanent disagreement over what it wants from Brexit. The major negotiation is going on within the Tory party. Having listened to some of the things going on in the Labour Party conference, I'm starting to think the same applies to the Labour Party. What we have is that two major national parties, neither of which can actually agree on what they want. Not a great starting point.
It really isn't. Jacob, just a final thought on this one. Where we currently are, do you actually think this is ever going to happen?
John is shaking his head, and I'm sort of inclined to agree with that. I mean, I think the odds of it not happening at the start seem quite low. And now I don't know if not happening formally, but you can imagine a British government looking at the shambles of negotiation and saying, let's see if we can cancel Article 50 and establish a permanent commission to study the impact of exiting the European Union. Say, we will eventually exit the European Union, but it'll be once we've completed this sort of Chilcot inquiry style long, what it'll do for the air traffic control regulations and the cattle regulations, and sort of going through and basically just trying to put as much distance between now and that distant horizon of Brexiting as possible in order to kick the can over the horizon.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Miller, along with John Everard and Jacob Parakilis. Coming up next, is it too early to start wondering who is going to run against Trump?
Monocle has bureau around the world. In Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, London, Toronto, and New York City. In New York City, our bureau chief is Ed Stocker.
You really can be anyone you want to be in New York. You can dress exactly how you like. You can act exactly how you like. There's that tolerance and acceptance that I think perhaps doesn't exist quite like it does in New York in any other city in the world. There's an energy and excitement to living here, and that's what makes it a great place to work in and to also live.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Miller. Still with me are John Everard and Jacob Parakilis. Now, let's look at the United States. One of the many oddities of its political system is that there is no officially designated permanent leader of the opposition, at least until a presidential candidate is formally nominated by whichever party isn't in power. That mantle is therefore there to be grabbed by or awarded to anyone who appears deserving. And right now, many are hanging it on Elizabeth Warren, the Democratic senator from Massachusetts, to the extent that the Republican Party and the Republican Party sympathetic media are going out of their way to go after her. So is it too early to pile in on the 12-1 presently on offer for her as America's 46th president? Jacob, is that good value?
I wouldn't make a bet on anyone right now. I know it feels like it's been longer, but we're only 8 months into the Trump administration.
It does feel like 80 years.
The constant sort of stream of not just tweets, but stories and sort of incipient scandals and all the sort of decoration of the Trump administration, I think, has made that time, especially for those of us who sort of spend time following it, feel much longer. But it is still very early. And, you know, at this moment in 2005, people were talking about John Edwards, for example. John Edwards and his sort of, you know, his extraordinary eloquence.
That went well.
Precisely. Yeah. I mean, so if we say who's the, you know, and yes, Barack Obama was sort of on the radar, but it was, oh, but he has just been sworn in. He's just, you know, he was a state senator and then he became president. And this idea that you would go from being a state senator in 2004 to a U.S. senator in 2005 to presidential nominee in 2008 and president of the United States in 2009 seemed completely absurd. So, you know, and then, of course, in 2015, the idea that Donald Trump would be president of the United States was laughed at by, you know, the majority of political commentators.
And myself very much included.
Oh, and I didn't rate him when he, you know, to put my hand on my heart and say, you know, in truth, I thought he was another Herman Cain, but, you know, we were wrong.
You could have got a lot longer than 12 to 1 on Donald Trump.
You could have got
and
made a lot more money. So I think it's too early to make a specific. Now, you can talk about people who are in the running and people who are not, but I think sort of rating one of them more highly than the other, I think at the moment, is a bit premature.
John, if you were a Republican Party grandee, I'm going to go ahead and assume you're not. Is Elizabeth Warren or somebody like her somebody you would be scared of?
Yes, I think I might be. But I think if I thought my options through carefully, I wouldn't do what the Grand Old Party is doing at the moment. I mean, essentially what we're watching is a rerun of the attack campaign on Hillary Clinton, to which a lot of Republicans probably still attribute the victory of their man last year. In fact, I think the dynamic was quite different. I don't think the attack campaign on Hillary Clinton was anything like as effective as some of the pollsters claimed. And I think that the main reason that Donald Trump is now sitting in the White House was this great upsurge of anti-establishment feeling that fueled his campaign. So that attacking Elizabeth Warren, probably not an effective use of Republican resources, extensive though those are. And of course, if you are attacked by conservative Republicans, it actually bolsters your image amongst your own base. People who, the PACs hate tend to look pretty good amongst Democrat voters.
Well, let me just add one thing to that, though, because the campaign against Hillary Clinton was 30 years long. This is somebody, entire generations of voters, people who are, you know, themselves old enough to run for Senate or president, had their lives defined by hating Hillary Clinton. So you don't have time, regardless of the effectiveness. You don't have time to run that campaign against Elizabeth Warren because it takes decades of sustained vilification to drive those numbers as low as they were for her.
I mean, John, should aspiring Democrats regard the possibility of running against Donald Trump as a unique opportunity? Because I think there is a widespread assumption that after another 3 years and change of this, he will be, if he lasts that long, fairly thoroughly discredited. And it seems unlikely that his administration is going to accomplish terribly much of what he said he would. But then again, of course, you have to then face the possibility that you are actually going to have to devote 2 years of your life to running against Donald Trump, which is a fairly, I mean, that would be a fairly undignified ordeal as political tests go.
Yes, it would be, you're quite right. Not one that anyone would want to take on lightly. But I suspect that there are any number of quite highly qualified people who are more than prepared to take this on. And one of the interesting things shaping up as 2020 is the imbalance of talent between the two parties. The Democrats have got much better people, much more plausible ones, not just Elizabeth Warren, than the Republicans have. I mean, one of the reasons that Donald Trump came through was that the Republican system simply failed to produce the kind of people who put, you know, fire in Americans' heart in quite the way that he did.
Should Joe Biden run, Jacob? He won't quite rule it out. He will be 77. I get the impression that he's rather regretting not running this time out. I'm pretty sure he would have beaten Donald Trump fairly handily.
I'm not sure about that. I think
really?
So. Biden,
I would have thought Biden, he would have got quite. The people who are driven by that rage against Hillary Clinton might not have been as motivated, and he would have got a fair whack of the angry old white guy vote as well.
Put it like this: Biden spent 8 years being Obama's number two, and he performed that job admirably. He also performed the sort of role of national fun uncle. He was sort of, you know, as the Onion had it, he was the guy who washed his Camaro in the driveway of the White House, and, you know, was going to cool his heels in Tijuana for a while. You know, and he sort of leaned into that persona very effectively. He's clearly a charismatic guy. He makes gaffes, but he kind of has I wouldn't quite compare it to Trump, but there's a similar phenomenon where if you make enough gaffes, they become a protective screen rather than a sort of, oh God, look how awkward this guy was. But let's not forget, Biden ran for president in 2008 and he ran for president in 1988. He didn't accumulate a single delegate in either of those runs. Mm-hmm. He does not necessarily work as the top guy on the slot, on the ticket. You know, he's charismatic, but his appeal has limits. And let's also not forget, I think Trump's approach of, you know, sort of systematically disemboweling the people arrayed against him is a particular kind of sort of male dominance politics. Now, he switched over to Clinton, but that approach, again, was based on sort of, it was based on partisanship and it was based on a long-running campaign against Clinton. I think a campaign with Trump versus Biden would have looked very different, but also bear in mind that Trump, you know, successfully went through and sort of disemboweled. And I agree with John, it wasn't the most talented field the Republicans ever put up, but there were some fairly big, you know, big names in that group. And Trump basically just bullied them off the stage. And I think he would have run the same kind of campaign against Biden. And I don't think you can discount the possibility that it would have been highly effective.
Okay, well, finally tonight, Vale Hugh Hefner, who obviously won't be running for president, though I suspect he might have thought about it post-Trump, founder and publisher of Playboy, of course, has died after 91 years, which he gave every indication of enjoying. The obituaries, think pieces and sundry hot takes which have already appeared in the wake of his passing have tended to take the view that Hefner was either a pioneering liberal crusader who shook the staid post-war culture from its slumber, or an exploitative sex pest who grew ever creepier with age. So where on the spectrum between those two should he be placed? John, were you a regular reader of his journal at any point?
No. I'm afraid I wasn't. I clearly missed out on a major formative experience, but there we go, too late now. I think, I mean, the element of all those in a very complex and a very expansive kind of personality. I mean, I became aware of Playboy at a time when already it was starting to look just a little bit sleazy, the kind of thing that you found, you know, well thumbed on the top shelves of not so reputable news agents. But it's easy to forget that at the beginning, this was a revolution. You know, the idea that you could not only talk about sex, but actually do it was, to many people, profoundly un-American, and really sort of, you know, shattered a lot of the complacency of 1950s America. Our societies actually owe Hugh Hefner much more than a lot of conservatives are prepared to admit.
I mean, Jacob, his impact, or Playboy's impact specifically on 1950s America, does seem to have been fairly seismic, comparable perhaps with the first primordial stirrings of rock and roll. But six decades on from that, does he emerge on the credit side of the ledger, or did it all just get a little bit odd?
There are certainly, and I think we have to acknowledge, talking about Hefner, that there are a lot of stories about his sort of, you know, dismissive conduct towards the women who stayed in the Playboy mansion, that he is at the very least a complicated character. And, you know, certainly without discounting the impact that he had on the culture of the 50s. I mean, you know, I grew up in the 80s and 90s, and Playboy was at that point not quite a joke, but it was sort of, it was the, oh, I only read it for the articles laugh line. It wasn't a cultural force. You didn't have people kind of, you know, in my generation, or at least that I was aware of, sort of talking about articles written in Playboy or talking about other things that appeared in Playboy. It wasn't just, it wasn't really sort of part of the cultural conversation in the way that I imagine it was in the 50s and 60s and 70s.
It is weird because that old gag about you know, reading it for the articles just became it became an old joke, then a joke about a joke, and then a joke about a joke about a joke. But the actual literary contribution of Playboy was not inconsequential. Norman Mailer, Kurt Vonnegut, Gore Vidal, Margaret Atwood, and so on and so on.
Nabokov, yes, that's right. I mean, he actually published these guys. I think Fahrenheit 451 was published entirely by Playboy, yep, in the first instance. Yes, this is not an insignificant contribution to serious letters, and we shouldn't forget that.
Is it possible, do you think, anymore, Jacob, that a single publication or journal or even a website can have that kind of impact anymore? Or has the culture become... It's the same argument discussion people have about, you know, I guess in the same way that it's hard to imagine you could have another Beatles or Rolling Stones or Elvis.
I think it's more diffuse. It's about platforms. I mean, you didn't have platforms like Facebook or Twitter in the same way when Playboy came out. And those have an influence. Now, it's much more diffuse because what goes on a platform isn't necessarily... It's shaped broadly by the people running it, but it's not... You know, Facebook doesn't sort of say you can only put this kind of content. They have very, very wide restrictions, and indeed they and Twitter both have been broadly and in some ways rightly criticized for not doing that. I think it's difficult for a magazine or a newspaper to have, or journal to have, the same kind of impact in that environment. But, you know, you still have 100 million people a month looking at the New York Times website. You still have significant reach into certainly parts of cultures and societies by. So I think, you know, you can have an impact, but quantifying it is very difficult.
Well, that does bring us to the end of today's show. Jacob Parakilis and John Everard, thank you for joining us at Midori House. It was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Sophia Armadi and Katie Watkins. Our studio manager was David Stevens. Music next at 1900. Andrew Tuck is in with The Urbanist. There's more on the day's big stories on The Daily at 2200. I'll be back tomorrow at the same time with Midori House, 1800 London. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.